Chapter 3. Reclining her head upon Mr. Lever's shoulder, and Mr. Lever grasping her hand with great fervor, and looking in her face from time to time with a melancholy and sympathetic aspect. The widow sat apart, feigning to be occupied with a book, but stealthily observing them from behind her fan, and the two firemen watermen, smoking their pipes on the bank hard by, nudged each other, and grinned in enjoyment of the joke. Very few of the party missed the loving couple, and the few who did, heartily congratulated each other on their disappearance. The contradictory couple, one would suppose that two people who are to pass their whole lives together, and must necessarily be very often alone with each other, could find little pleasure in mutual contradiction. And yet what is more common than a contradictory couple? The contradictory couple agree in nothing but contradiction. They return home from Mrs. Bluebottle's dinner party, each in an opposite corner of the coach, and do not exchange a syllable until they have been seated for at least 20 minutes by the fireside at home, when the gentleman, raising his eyes from the stove, all at once breaks silence. "What a very extraordinary thing it is," apostrophe says he, "that you will contradict Charlotte. Apostrophe, 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 I contradict. Apostrophe," cries the lady, "but that's just like you." "Apostrophe, what's like me?" apostrophe says the gentleman sharply. "Saying that I contradict you," apostrophe replies the lady. "Do you mean to say that you do not contradict me?" apostrophe, apostrophe retorts the gentleman. "Do you mean to say that you have not been contradicting me the whole of this day?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "do you mean to tell me now that you have not?" "I mean to tell you nothing of the kind," apostrophe replies the lady quietly. "When you are wrong, of course I shall contradict you." Apostrophe, during this dialogue the gentleman has been taking his brandy and water on one side of the fire, and the lady, with her dressing case on the table, has been curling her hair on the other. She now lets down her back hair, and proceeds to brush it, preserving at the same time an air of conscious rectitude and suffering virtue, which is intended to exasperate the gentleman and does so. "I do believe," apostrophe he says, taking the spoon out of his glass, and tossing it on the table, "that of all the obstinate, positive, wrong-headed creatures that were ever born, you are the most so, Charlotte." "Apostrophe, certainly, certainly, have it your own way, pray. You see how much I contradict you," apostrophe rejoins the lady. "Of course, you didn't contradict me at dinner time, oh no, not you." Apostrophe, apostrophe says the gentleman. "Yes, I did," apostrophe says the lady. "Oh, you did," cries the gentleman, "you admit that?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "if you call that contradiction, I do," apostrophe the lady answers. "And I say again, Edward, that when I know you are wrong, I will contradict you. I am not your slave." Apostrophe, "not my slave," apostrophe repeats the gentleman bitterly. "And you still mean to say that in the Blackburns' new house there are not more than 14 doors, including the door of the wine cellar?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "I mean to say," apostrophe retorts the lady, beating time with her hairbrush on the palm of her hand, "that in that house there are 14 doors and no more." Apostrophe, "well then," apostrophe cries the gentleman, rising in despair, and pacing the room with rapid strides. "By G, this is enough to destroy a man's intellect, and drive him mad." Apostrophe, apostrophe, by and by the gentleman comes to a little, and passing his hand gloomily across his forehead, reseats himself in his former chair. There is a long silence, and this time the lady begins. "I appealed to Mr. Jenkins, who sat next to me on the sofa in the drawing room during tea," apostrophe Morgan. "You mean," apostrophe interrupts the gentleman. "I do not mean anything of the kind," apostrophe answers the lady. "Now, by all that is aggravating and impossible to bear," apostrophe cries the gentleman, clenching his hands and looking upwards in agony. She is going to insist upon it that Morgan is Jenkins. Do you take me for a perfect fool? Exclaims the lady. Do you suppose I don't know the one from the other? Do you suppose I don't know that the man in the blue coat was Mr. Jenkins? Jenkins in a blue coat. Cries the gentleman with a groan. Jenkins in a blue coat. A man who would suffer death, rather than wear anything but brown. Do you dare to charge me with telling an untruth? Demands the lady, bursting into tears. I charge you, ma'am, retorts the gentleman, starting up, with being a monster of contradiction, a monster of aggravation, Jenkins in a blue coat. What have I done, that I should be doomed to hear such statements? Expressing himself with great scorn and anguish, the gentleman takes up his candle and stalks off to bed, where feigning to be fast asleep, when the lady comes upstairs drowned in tears, murmuring lamentations over her hard fate and indistinct intentions of consulting her brothers, he undergoes the secret torture of hearing her exclaim between whiles, I know there are only 14 doors in the house, I know it was Mr. Jenkins, I know he had a blue coat on, and I would say it as positively as I do now, if they were the last words I had to speak. If the contradictory couple are blessed with children, they are not the less contradictory on that account. Master James and Miss Charlotte present themselves after dinner, and being in perfect good humor, and finding their parents in the same amiable state, augur from these appearances half a glass of wine apiece and other extraordinary indulgences. But unfortunately Master James, growing talkative upon such prospects, asks his mama how tall Mrs. Parsons is, and whether she is not 6 feet high. To which his mama replies, yes, she should think she was, for Mrs. Parsons is a very tall lady indeed, quite a giantess. For heaven's sake, Charlotte, cries her husband, do not tell the child such preposterous nonsense. 6 feet high. Well, replies the lady, surely I may be permitted to have an opinion. My opinion is, that she is 6 feet high at least 6 feet. Now you know, Charlotte, retorts the gentleman sternly, that is not your opinion, that you have no such idea, and that you only say this for the sake of contradiction. You are exceedingly polite, his wife replies, to be wrong about such a paltry question as anybody's height would be no great crime, but I say again, that I believe Mrs. Parsons, to be 6 feet more than 6 feet. Nay, I believe you know her to be full 6 feet, and only say she is not, because I say she is. This taunt disposes the gentleman to become violent, but he cheeks himself, and is content to mutter, in a haughty tone, 6 feet, ha, ha. Mrs. Parsons, 6 feet. And the lady answers, yes, 6 feet. I am sure I am glad you are amused, and I'll say it again 6 feet. Thus the subject gradually drops off, and the contradiction begins to be forgotten, when Master James, with some undefined notion of making himself agreeable, and putting things to rights again, unfortunately asks his mama what the moon's made of, which gives her occasion to say that he had better not ask her, for she is always wrong, and never can be right, that he only exposes her to contradiction by asking any question of her, and that he had better ask his papa, who is infallible, and never can be wrong. Papa, smarting under this attack, gives a terrible pull at the bell, and says, that if the conversation is to proceed in this way, the children had better be removed. Removed they are, after a few tears and many struggles, and Pa, having looked at Ma sideways for a minute or two, with a billful eye, draws his pocket handkerchief over his face, and composes himself for his after-dinner nap. The friends of the contradictory couple often deplore their frequent disputes, though they rather make light of them at the same time. Observing that there is no doubt they are very much attached to each other, and that they never quarrel except about trifles. But neither the friends of the contradictory couple, nor the contradictory couple themselves, reflect that as the most stupendous objects in nature are but vast collections of minute particles, so the slightest and least considered trifles make up the sum of human happiness or misery. The couple who dote upon their children, the couple who dote upon their children have usually a great many of them, 6 or 8 at least. The children are either the healthiest in all the world, or the most unfortunate in existence. In either case, they are equally the theme of their doting parents, and equally a source of mental anguish and irritation to their doting parents' friends. The couple who dote upon their children recognize no dates, but those connected with their births, accidents, illnesses, or remarkable deeds. They keep a mental almanac with a vast number of innocent days, all in red letters. They recollect the last coronation, because on that day little Tom fell down the kitchen stairs, the anniversary of the gunpowder plot, because it was on the 5th of November that Ned asked whether wooden legs were made in heaven and cocked hats grew in gardens. Mrs. Whiffler will never cease to recollect the last day of the old year, as long as she lives, for it was on that day that the baby had the 4 red spots on its nose which they took for measles. Nor Christmas Day, for 21 days after Christmas Day the twins were born. Nor Good Friday, for it was on a Good Friday that she was frightened by the donkey cart when she was in the family way with Georgina. The movable feasts have no motion for Mr. and Mrs. Whiffler, but remain pinned down tight and fast to the shoulders of some small child, from whom they can never be separated anymore. Time was made, according to their creed, not for slaves, but for girls and boys. The restless sands in his glass are but little children at play. As we have already intimated, the children of this couple can know no medium. They are either prodigies of good health or prodigies of bad health. Whatever they are, they must be prodigies. Mr. Whiffler must have to describe at his office such excruciating agonies constantly undergone by his eldest boy, as nobody else's eldest boy ever underwent, or he must be able to declare that there never was a child endowed with such amazing health, such an indomitable constitution, and such a cast-iron frame, as his child. His children must be, in some respect or other, above and beyond the children of all other people. To such an extent is this feeling pushed, that we were once slightly acquainted with a lady and gentleman who carried their heads so high, and became so proud after their youngest child fell out of a 2-pair of stairs window without hurting himself much, that the greater part of their friends were obliged to forego their acquaintance. But perhaps this may be an extreme case, and one not justly entitled to be considered as a precedent of general application. If a friend happen to dine in a friendly way with one of these couples who dote upon their children, it is nearly impossible for him to divert the conversation from their favorite topic. Everything reminds Mr. Whiffler of Ned, or Mrs. Whiffler of Marianne, or of the time before Ned was born, or the time before Marianne was thought of. The slightest remark, however harmless in itself, will awaken slumbering recollections of the twins. It is impossible to steer clear of them. They will come uppermost, let the poor man do what he may. Ned has been known to be lost sight of for half an hour, Dick has been forgotten, the name of Marianne has not been mentioned, but the twins will out. Nothing can keep down the twins. It's a very extraordinary thing, Saunders, apostrophe says Mr. Whiffler to the visitor, but you have seen our little babies, the twins? Apostrophe apostrophe the friend's heart sinks within him as he answers, oh, yes often. Apostrophe you're talking of the pyramids, apostrophe says Mr. Whiffler, quite as a matter of course, reminds me of the twins. It's a very extraordinary thing about those babies, what color should you say their eyes were? Apostrophe, apostrophe, upon my word. Apostrophe, the friend stammers. I hardly know how to answer, the fact being that except as the friend does not remember to have heard of any departure from the ordinary course of nature in the instance of these twins, they might have no eyes at all for aught he has observed to the contrary. He wouldn't say they were red, I suppose? Apostrophe, apostrophe, says Mr. Whiffler. The friend hesitates, and rather thinks they are, but inferring from the expression of Mr. Whiffler's face that red is not the color, smiles with some confidence, and says, no, no, very different from that. Apostrophe, what should you say to blue? Apostrophe, says Mr. Whiffler. The friend glances at him, and observing a different expression in his face, ventures to say, I should say they were blue, a decided blue. Apostrophe, to be sure. Apostrophe, cries Mr. Whiffler, triumphantly, I knew you would. But what should you say, if I was to tell you, that the boy's eyes are blue, and the girl's hazel, eh? Apostrophe, apostrophe, impossible. Apostrophe, exclaims the friend, not at all knowing why it should be impossible. A fact, notwithstanding, apostrophe, cries Mr. Whiffler, and let me tell you, Saunders, that's not a common thing in twins, or a circumstance that'll happen every day. Apostrophe, in this dialogue Mrs. Whiffler, as being deeply responsible for the twins, their charms and singularities, has taken no share, but she now relates, in broken English, a witticism of Little Dick's bearing upon the subject just discussed, which delights Mr. Whiffler beyond measure, and causes him to declare that he would have sworn that was Dick's, if he had heard it anywhere. Then he requests that Mrs. Whiffler will tell Saunders what Tom said about mad bulls, and Mrs. Whiffler relating the anecdote, a discussion ensues upon the different character of Tom's wit and Dick's wit, from which it appears that Dick's humor is of a lively turn, while Tom's style is the dry and caustic. This discussion, being enlivened by various illustrations, lasts a long time, and is only stopped by Mrs. Whiffler instructing the footman to ring the nursery bell, as the children were promised that they should come down and taste the pudding. The friend turns pale when this order is given, and paler still when it is followed up by a great pattering on the staircase, not unlike the sound of rain upon a skylight. A violent bursting open of the dining room door, and the tumultuous appearance of six small children, closely succeeded by a strong nursery maid with a twin in each arm. As the whole eight are screaming, shouting, or kicking, some influenced by a ravenous appetite, some by a horror of the stranger, and some by a conflict of the two feelings, a pretty long space elapses before all their heads can be ranged round the table, and anything like order restored, in bringing about which happy state of things both the nurse and footman are severely scratched. At length Mrs. Whiffler is heard to say, apostrophe, Mr. Saunders, shall I give you some pudding? Apostrophe, apostrophe, a breathless silence ensues, and 16 small eyes are fixed upon the guest in expectation of his reply. A wild shout of joy proclaims that he has said no, thank you. Apostrophe, spoons are waved in the air, legs appear above the tablecloth in uncontrollable ecstasy, and 80 short fingers dabble in damson syrup. While the pudding is being disposed of, Mr. and Mrs. Whiffler look on with beaming countenances, and Mr. Whiffler, nudging his friend Saunders, begs him to take notice of Tom's eyes, or Dick's chin, or Ned's nose, or Mary Ann's hair, or Emily's figure, or little Bob's calves, or Fanny's mouth, or Carrie's head, as the case may be. Whatever the attention of Mr. Saunders is called to, Mr. Saunders admires, of course, though he is rather confused about the sex of the youngest branches and looks at the wrong children, turning to a girl, when Mr. Whiffler directs his attention to a boy, and falling into raptures with a boy, when he ought to be enchanted with a girl. Then the dessert comes, and there is a vast deal of scrambling after fruit, and sudden spurting forth of juice out of tight oranges into infant eyes, and much screeching and wailing in consequence. At length it becomes time for Mrs. Whiffler to retire, and all the children are by force of arms compelled to kiss and love Mr. Saunders before going upstairs, except Tom, who, lying on his back in the hall, proclaims that Mr. Saunders is a naughty beast. Apostrophe and Dick, who having drunk his father's wine, when he was looking another way, is found to be intoxicated, and is carried out, very limp and helpless. Mr. Whiffler and his friend are left alone together, but Mr. Whiffler's thoughts are still with his family, if his family are not with him. Saunders, apostrophe says he, after a short silence, if you please, we'll drink Mrs. Whiffler and the children. Apostrophe Mr. Saunders feels this to be a reproach against himself for not proposing the same sentiment, and drinks it in some confusion. Ah! Apostrophe Mr. Whiffler sighs, these children, Saunders, make one quite an old man. Apostrophe Mr. Saunders thinks that, if they were his, they would make him a very old man, but he says nothing. And yet, apostrophe pursues Mr. Whiffler, what can equal domestic happiness? What can equal the Gutenberg edition? End of chapter.